Morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. And first of all, I would like to thank the organizers, Daniel and Frame, for inviting me to be here. It's wonderful to be in this great city. And over the next 30 minutes or so, I'll tell you a little bit about my group's work, recent work. Hopefully, I won't disappoint you. Maybe some of you have expected some a little bit of the update on ion-related research, but I'll talk about quantum dots. That's what my group does. And I'll tell you, of course, about our quantum information processing work, but also about single photon nonlinear optics. So let me actually start by describing the platform that we employ, because some of you may not be familiar with. We work with actually solid-state systems, quantum dots in photonic crystal cavities. Here are the structures that we employ. We actually use 160 to 170 nanometer thick cavities. Okay, I think I'll shift to the laser pointer. So we use 160 to 170 nanometer thick structures made of gallium arsenide. And indium arsenide quantum dots are embedded at the center of these plots. Photonic crystal, which is the structure that's used to localize light, is actually produced by etching periodic arrays of air holes inside of these plots. Quantum dots are made of indium arsenide, and this is 1 micrometer squared array of such dots. They are actually white spots surrounded by gallium arsenide. And they exhibit very nice atom-like properties. The quantum dots that we employ in our work actually operate in the range between 920 and 940 nanometers. Cavities, resonators that we use are produced by omitting several of these holes or changing their radii and so on. And this way, we can produce resonators that have volumes that are below cubic optical wavelength and have quality factors that are in the range of tens of thousands. This is, for instance, state-of-the-art quality factor in such material system in this wavelength range and 25,000. As a result of very small mode volume, half of the cubic optical wavelength in these structures, we can actually reach the strong coupling of cavity QED with quality factors that are 10,000, so with actually moderate values of quality factor. Theoretically, quality factor in this material system can go up to 100,000, but we're currently limited to this range as a result of absorption in the material and also fabrication imperfections. And here you can also see scanning electron micrograph image of the fabricated resonator. You see the scale bar of 2 microns. So these structures are really several micrometers in size. Okay, so let me actually explain you also how strong coupling we can reach in this particular material. I don't have to explain this to this audience, but let me just remind you that the strong coupling regime of cavity QED is reached when the coupling strength, or Rabi frequency, exceeds the loss rates of the system. Coupling strength between the quantum dot and the cavity field is inversely proportional to square root of the mode volume, and cavity field decay rate is inversely proportional to the quality factor. When G exceeds kappa, cavity field decay rate, and dipole decay rate, we reach the strong coupling of cavity QED, which is actually observed in this particular case in photoluminescence as anti-crossing between the cavity peak and the quantum dot peak. So what we do in this case, we tune the temperature of the chip, and that redshifts quantum dot, which is initially on the left-hand side of the cavity peak. As we increase the temperature slowly, quantum dot redshifts relative to the cavity resonance, but we always observe 2 peaks in the spectrum, and that's because the system is in the strong coupling. You can see also the movie with what happens with one of those samples in real time. As you see the temperature, you see 2 peaks anti-crossing each other. And if you track their positions as a function of the chip temperature, you can see very well-known anti-crossing curve. This is the result in photoluminescence. Again, as a result of very small volume, we can actually reach this regime with our cavities that have quality factor of 10,000 or more, and currently we're in the range of around 25,000. Why is this platform interesting for us? Well, there are several advantages relative to the atomic physics platform that is shown on the left. First, the whole system has a nanoscale. It's produced on chip. You don't have to trap an atom because quantum dot is naturally trapped inside of the structure. And on top of that, as a result of the very small mode volume, Rabi frequency is in the gigahertz range. We're currently at the 25 gigahertz range. It could also be 100 gigahertz. So if you're interested in making devices, switching devices or quantum gates that control your speed, so you can actually make devices that are much faster than the devices that you make using macroscale resonators in atomic physics. And that's the reason why we're motivated to use for this particular platform, but in the process we also have to address some challenges, and that's what I'll be telling you in my talk today. So first I'll start by describing local tuning techniques that we use for quantum dots, because this technique was crucial for performing a couple of the experiments that I'll then proceed with describing. And I'll focus on four particular experiments. First, control of the cavity reflectivity with a single quantum dot, or coherent probing of the strong coupling cavity QED. Then control the amplitude and phase shifts with a single quantum dot. Fast electro-optical switching with a quantum dot. That's one of the more recent experiments where we combine optical and electrical control, and coherent generation of non-classical light on chip via photon-induced tunneling and locate. And at the very end, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the ideas that we have for our future work. So let me start with the description of the first experiment. This set of techniques that I'll tell you about was developed over the past 2 years in my group, and they're crucial, as I mentioned, for the experiments that we're performing. Those of you who have done any work with indium arsenide quantum dots or other solid-state emitters know that quantum dots are suffering from inhomogeneous broadening. They are produced by molecular beam epitaxy, and there is a discrepancy between their sizes, and as a result of that, they have different transition energies. And because of that, it's very challenging to make any sort of integrated structure where you would be interested in coupling several quantum dots, because even if your fabrication is completely perfect, and if your resonators are exactly tuned to each other, then you will often end up with a situation that quantum dot inside one of these resonators is on resonance, but in the other case, it's off resonance. So the question is, how do you tune this quantum dot without affecting this one here or the other areas of the chip? That's not only the case for quantum dots, it's also the case with other solid-state emitters. Once they're embedded in the solid-state environment, they're affected by a lot of other things. And initially, around 2 years ago, we started developing these local tuning techniques. The first idea that we had was to use local temperature tuning using laser beam that's absorbed in the area near quantum dots that we need to tune. And this way, we can actually induce the temperature shift of the quantum dot here without significantly affecting areas that are a couple of microns or more apart. This way, we can actually tune the other quantum dot and keep this one in resonance. Here is how the first set of structures that we use look like, and you'll see actually the same configuration repeated for at least the first couple of experiments that I'll tell you about today. We have, again, our cavity, and usually we use this cavity design, although there will be some variations on this theme in some of the later experiments. And next to the cavity, we deposit chrome gold metallic pad, which we call heating pad, and you'll see in some of the figures. The reason why we do that is because we would like to absorb the heating beam without inducing photoluminescence in the sample. So we use heating beam, which is below the band gap of gallium arsenide surrounding semiconductor, and that implies that the beam is not generating carriers and is not inducing photoluminescence, but can be absorbed in this heating pad here and can induce temperature gradient across the structure and locally shift the wavelength of the quantum dot. Same as in the first slide that I showed you, but again, this just happens in this particular area of the chip. Obviously, we also have another laser that we use to probe the cavity, and usually we probe it in this vertical configuration, although you also see some experiments later in the talk where we probe it in the lateral integrated configuration. So here is now how the fabricated structure looks like. On the left, you see a heating pad, that's chrome gold area, and here you see a cavity. The quantum dot is embedded at the center, so it's not really visible from the outside. As you increase the power of the heating laser, and here is the range of power before the lens that's focusing the laser on the structure, you can see that the quantum dot resonance redshifts, and it can be redshifted by about 1.5 nanometers without severe degradation. This is much more than what we need actually to do in our experiments, because cavity line width is 0.1 nanometers or less. So we usually shift it only in one-tenth of this range, where degradation is really negligible. I should also point out that in the same process, you affect the cavity resonance. So cavity resonance also redshifts as a result of the change in refractive index. But the redshift of the cavity resonance is 3 to 4 times slower than the shift of the quantum dot resonance. This is important because it implies that the quantum dot shifts faster than the cavity, so it can catch up with the cavity and you can tune it on resonance. But obviously you may get concerned by the fact that in this process I tune quantum dot on resonance, but then I detune the cavity. So the question is, how do I then tune cavities back on resonance? And we have an independent degree of freedom, an independent tuning technique for cavities which is not affecting quantum dots, and that's tuning using photorefractive materials. is described in this reference, but I will not really have time to tell you about it unless someone would like to learn about it in the question session. Anyway, using this technique, we can tune quantum dot both into the weak and strong coupling regime with a cavity. In this particular case, I show you a result for the strong coupling regime, mostly to get you familiar with some of the plots that you'll see later in the talk. This is very similar to the first plot that I showed you in the talk today. Again, I show you photoluminescent spectrum. Quantum dot is initially on the left-hand side of the cavity resonance, and as we move above, towards the top of the slide here, you can see that the quantum dot redshifts and anticrosses the cavity. But the difference relative to the slide I showed you earlier is that in this case, we increase the power of the heating laser beam. So different plots correspond to the different power. And powers are on the order of tens of microwatts before the lens, so we really tune the system in a very, very small range where there is no quantum dot degradation. If you track cavity and quantum dot wavelengths, you see anticrossing curve, and later you'll see some plots that resemble this one. On the vertical axis, we have temperature scan cycle, so this is the heating laser power increasing towards the bottom as you go from top towards the bottom, and on the horizontal axis, you have wavelength. You see that the quantum dot redshifts as you increase the laser power, and the cavity also redshifts, but they anticross each other. So cavity is this broader line, and quantum dot is a narrower line. So we can bring the system into the strong coupling regime, and we use this for some of the experiments that you'll see later. It's a very powerful technique. Very recently, we started actually shifting towards more practical configuration. Again, you can raise the question that if you use this technique for making any sort of quantum circuits, for more than three or four quantum dots, it would be extremely complicated because you would need a laser to tune each one of them independently. This is the reason why we recently shifted to ohmic heaters, and this is described in the reference at the bottom of the slide. Instead of using heating pads and tuning them, heating them using external lasers, we're now actually using these electrical heaters, which we're connecting to the power supply, and you can actually have multi-port power supplies connecting to the individual electrical heaters. They're deposited next to the cavity. There are different designs that we are probing. As you increase voltage on the power supply, that increases, obviously, the temperature, the power, and that way you are also redshifting the cavity, which is the broader line here, and redshifting the quantum dot. In this particular case, they also anticross. They exhibit a strong coupling regime, and obviously this is exactly the same effect as the one that I showed you before, except that the power is proportional to voltage squared, so you see this parabolic shift instead of the linear shift. Okay, so far for the tuning techniques. Now let me move on to the interesting experiments that we can do using this platform and using these tuning techniques. The first in the series of experiments that I'd like to tell you about is this coherent probing of the strongly coupled cavity QED system, or control of the cavity reflectivity with a single quantum dot. The configuration for the experiment is shown here. This is just part of the experimental setup, but just to give you a main idea, we have the chip here, and we probe it, in this particular case, in the perpendicular direction. This is our objective lens, and we probe it actually in reflectivity because this was easier for the initial experiment. But because of the a large noise and reflected signal in the background, we use so-called cross-polarized reflectivity setup, which improves signal-to-noise ratio. What that means is that we're actually sighting the structure with the laser beam, which is slightly detuned from the main axis of the cavity mode, and then we're collecting the signal, which is 90 degrees orthogonal to the excitation. This way, we can actually reject the strong direct reflection from the background and actually collect only the signal that is coupled to the cavity. If you do analysis of this particular system, you can see that the cross-polarized reflectivity setup is basically the same as measurement of the transmission of the system. We also have some transmission measurements, but this will basically tell you that the expectation for what you should see in this experiment is that for the system, without any coupled quantum dot, you should, in this cross-polarized reflectivity, see nice Lorentzian spectrum, and once you have quantum dot coupled to the cavity, it should induce a dip in the cavity reflectivity. How is this different from the first experiment that I showed you? Well, up until this work, everyone had only done probing of the solid-state cavity QED systems in photoluminescence. which is good for the first experimental demonstration, but as we all know, it's actually not very useful for quantum information processing, and also can lead to some ambiguous results. And in this case, we actually did coherent probing using external laser, which we scanned across the cavity resonance, the same way that people do it in atomic physics. And here is the result. If you have quantum dot that is detuned from the cavity resonance, and in this case we use local temperature tuning to tune quantum dot in and out of the resonance, the technique that I just described you, here is the reflectivity spectrum. You see empty cavity, nice Lorentzian peak, which matches the peak that you see from photoluminescence. Quality factor is around 10,000. When you tune quantum dot onto the cavity resonance, you see a dip in the cavity reflectivity, and this dip appears at the point where quantum dot is resonant. This exactly matches the data that you see in photoluminescence, and this is actually the first coherent probing of solid-state cavity QED system. Don't get confused by the horizontal axis. This is related to that temperature scanning cycle, but that's basically quantum dot wavelength. It's exactly the same thing as wavelength, but here I write heating cycle just because that's what we use for tuning. After this initial experiment, we also did that coherent probing measurement in the integrated configuration. Obviously, that would be the main strength of such on-chip system. And here you can see sort of level of the complexity of the networks that we're at right now, or where we were about a year ago. We have the structure that consists of the cavity. Output from the cavity is outcoupled to photonic crystal waveguide, and then we have a grating outcoupler which redirects the signal into the direction vertical relative to the chip. So we couple signal to the cavity is here, and we outcouple it via waveguide and grating coupler. We also have the heating pad. In this case, we use laser heating, that was about a year ago, to tune the quantum dot inside of the cavity resonance. And then the signal, which is outcoupled via grating coupler, exhibits a nice dipping transmission. Again, the same way as what we do in the reflectivity. Some of the most recent cavity QED experiments that we performed, which haven't been published yet, but they are on archive, are shown here. We're actually excited that we're first now able to coherently probe the system, even by tuning a laser. The same way that people do it in atomic physics. Initially, we were not really able to scan the laser across the resonance because we have relatively small rabi splitting, and we couldn't stabilize lasers enough to actually observe these dips. That's why we had to keep the laser stable and tune quantum dot in the cavity across the laser resonance. Now what we do is basically just keep the system fixed, tune quantum dot onto the resonance, and then scan the laser across the system. And here you see nice splitting. We're in the range where our rabi frequency is on the order of 25 gigahertz. That's limited by the misalignment between the position of the quantum dot and the cavity field maximum. Could be even higher than that, but that's improvement relative to where we were a couple of years ago. The other thing that we were able to do was time-resolved reflectivity measurement, where we were able to observe the first cycle of rabi oscillation. And here you see basically that the system exhibits rabi oscillation with a period of 39 picoseconds, which matches very well 25 gigahertz rabi frequency. As you crank up the probing power, this basically oscillation saturates, and you just see decay, and that's expected from the saturation of the system. So these are some of the most recent cavity QED experiments. Again, very interesting, and showing that in principle, this platform is very comparable to the atomic physics platform and useful for performing quantum information processing. Why is this interesting? Well, if you tune quantum dot onto the cavity resonance and do the reflectivity or transmission measurement, you will see strong dipping in the cavity peak. The other thing that we know from atomic physics and from theory is that if you increase the probe laser power, that dip would start to saturate. And this is what we also observe in our system. As you increase the probe laser power in such a way that the average cavity photon number approaches one, the dip would be saturating. And that exactly happens here. And this is just the scan of that dip as a function of the input power. So you have actually a very interesting feature of the system that you can completely change the reflectivity of the system once you tune quantum dot onto it and the system is strongly coupled, and then you can saturate this dip just by increasing the input laser power in such a way that the average photon number in the cavity is 1. And that roughly corresponds to 20 nanowatts of power. So even if you are not able to actually build the actual quantum network with this system. It's actually very useful for something else. You can make an optical switch that is controlled with extremely low energy. Obviously, this reflectivity at this point is switched with a single control photon, 20 nanowatts or a single control photon. So you can envision making devices that look something like this. You have a strongly coupled quantum dot cavity system, and you have an input photon, input probe beam, which will be reflected in this case because the deep in the cavity reflectivity would appear. But if that photon is escorted with another photon, you would saturate the deep in the cavity reflectivity, and that would actually proceed together to the other side. Some of you may not be from actually optoelectronics or optical switching background, but this way you can actually make an all-optical switch, which is operated with control energies that are at a single photon level, so they are sub-autojoule, or if you actually calculate that in terms of powers, it's 10 nanowatts or so, and operating speeds could be 100 gigahertz, which is Rabi frequency of the system. State of the art today for all optical switches is tens of microwatts, and the speed is on the order of 20 gigahertz. So there is no way to actually reduce it by this many orders of magnitude by using standard approaches. Another strength of this system is that two photons that you use in this process, although I plotted them with different colors, they are resonant. They are actually within the cavity resonance, and they can be exactly the same wavelength. If you look how people make optical switches today, they use different wavelength photons. Control photons are used to actually inject free carriers in the system, and they're at much shorter wavelength. So those systems are not scalable if you're interested in making optical logic circuits. And they're interesting for making one device, but not scale to more of them. So that's one thing that you could do, unrelated to quantum information processing, but very, very interesting, certainly. And the other thing that you could do is making electro-optical switch. You have a empty cavity, or you detune quantum dots from the cavity resonance, your input signal is transmitted to the output. Then you use some other means, electrical control of the quantum dot onto the cavity resonance, that induces deep in the cavity reflectivity, and the signal is reflected back. This is electro-optical switch in this case. Again, it could be operated at much lower control energy, and I'll show you some experimental results like this. Obviously, on the quantum information side, which I'm sure all of us here can relate to even better, you can use this approach for building quantum gates, and I'll tell you a little bit about how this could potentially be useful for building control phase gates. So let me move on to the second part, second experiment. In the second experiment, we did controlled amplitude and phase shifts using this particular platform. Again, the experimental setup is exactly the same, and let me just remind you what you expect to see in this case. If you have an empty cavity, or you have a cavity with quantum dot, but quantum dot is tuned out of the resonance using one of the methods that we now have developed, in the amplitude of the reflected signal, in this cross-polarized reflectivity, we expect to see nice cavity Lorentzian peak, blue curve. If you measure the phase of the reflected signal, you expect to see the blue curve on the right, and this is as a function of the frequency. If we perform the measurement, that's what we'll see. If we then tune quantum dot back onto the cavity resonance using temperature tuning or electrical tuning that I'll tell you about later, then instead of seeing this curve, you will see a red curve for the amplitude of the reflected signal and red curve for the phase of the reflected signal. So you obviously expect to see deep in the amplitude of reflected signal, as I showed you before, but in the phase of reflected signal, you expect to see sharp changes around the point where quantum dot is coupled to the cavity. And this theoretically goes from pi half to minus pi half and potentially could be used to perform controlled phase shifts because just by tuning quantum dot in and out of the resonance, you go between blue and red curve, or by saturating the system, by tuning quantum dot under the resonance, you'll be on the red curve. And then by saturating the system, bringing another photon, you go back to the blue curve. So you have very large change in the phase at this particular point. We performed measurements of this, and I'll show you only part of the results. This is from 2008 paper. I'll show you results where we use two control and signal beams that are slightly at different wavelengths so that we could easily distinguish them, although we perform experiments with the same wavelength as well. They're slightly different wavelengths, but they're actually both tuned to the cavity resonance. And here is how the experiment looks like. We reflect the signal beam, we measure its amplitude and a phase, and then we also have a control beam which is coupled to the cavity, and we look what happens with control beam on or off. With control beam off, in the amplitude of the reflected signal, we see deep in reflectivity. This is not the situation when control beam is completely off, we still have 0.05 photons per cavity photon lifetime. But as we increase the control beam photon number around 1, the dip in the amplitude completely saturates. And you expect that from the previous results. The new thing here would be to show you what happens with phase. In phase, when control beam is almost completely off, you see in the phase of the amplitude, in the phase of the reflected signal beam, this sharp change, as I showed you in the theoretical plot. As you crank the control beam and you approach 1 photon per control beam, you will actually go back to the smooth curve, and at this particular point, you actually see a significant phase change just with turning the control beam on and off. For complete saturation of quantum dot, in our case, we can see up to pi over 4 phase shifts, and obviously for complete pi phase shifts, we have to cascade several of these elements. It's possible, theoretically, with realistic system parameters to go above pi over 4 in our system for complete saturation, but we're not there yet, and actually we haven't recently focused on this particular experiment. Another interesting thing that hasn't been published yet, it's under review at the moment, but I think it's very exciting, is electro-optical control of the strongly coupled system. This is similar to the cartoon that I showed you a little bit earlier, where we have some electrical signal that we use to control quantum dots and tune it onto the resonance and off the resonance with the cavity with which it is strongly coupled. We still use the same type of the cavity. We probe it in the reflectivity. Quantum dot is embedded at the center. And we have an electrode here that's deposited on the surface of the chip. And this acts as a Schottky diode, which induces electric field at the location of the quantum dot. This electrode, as you crank up the voltage, will increase the electric field at the location of the quantum dot and produce stark shifting. This is stark shifting of the energy levels of the quantum dot. And here is what happens experimentally. On this plot, you see what happens as a function of the applied voltage, and on the horizontal axis, you see wavelength. And this is reflectivity measurement on the system. So when voltage is zero, you see two peaks here, and this is the cross-section, and the two peaks correspond to basically two polaritons of the strongly coupled quantum dot cavity system. As you increase the voltage applied to this electrode, you will increase the field applied to the quantum dot, and that would be shifting the quantum dots relative to the cavity resonance. And here you actually exactly see that happening in this particular case. I'm wrapping it up. here is the quantum dot which is out of the resonance, and eventually you go back to the original cavity peak, right? So if you actually focus on this particular central wavelength here, you go from the dip, you're from small reflectivity to large reflectivity. So if you put the beam that you are actually reflecting exactly on this wavelength, and then you modulate the signal on the electrode, you will see significant change in the reflective beam amplitude. So this structure you can view actually is a single quantum dot controlled switch or electro-optic modulator. In this case, we estimate that it operates with less than femtojoule of energy, actual energy spent per operation. And the measured speed of the system is 150 megahertz, limited by the resistance and capacitance of the circuit. We know that theoretically it should be able to operate at 10 gigahertz, which is actually the Rabi frequency of the system. But we have to actually reduce resistances and capacitances of the transmission line that we use to load the circuit. Anyway, this is actually very interesting as well. Could be used for very fast control of the quantum dots. If you actually use cavity QED platform for quantum information processing, you can actually do very fast control and tuning. At the same time, you can do electro-optic switching classically. And as the last experiment, do I have a couple of minutes or a few more minutes? Right, okay, so that was warning before the very end. The last experiment that I'd like to tell you about is actually photon-induced tunneling and blockade, like in the series of experiments that we employed here and performed here. As you know, strongly coupled system exhibits the ladder of dress states. And if you have an empty cavity, you would actually just see Fock states, and energies would be actually omega naught to omega naught times h bar and so on. But then if you actually have the strongly coupled system, then the states would split to polaritons. And polaritons, the first order polaritons would be omega naught plus minus g, where g is Rabi frequency, and then 2 omega naught plus minus root 2 g, and so on. The important thing about this system is that the ladder of dress states is unharmonic. So if you actually excite one of the first order polaritons with that frequency, you would not be able to reach any other states in the ladder. And this was explored theoretically by Attachi Mamoglu in 1999 for demonstration of photon blockade. photon blockade effect, where actually you shine a Poissonian statistics input beam, laser beam, into the system. It's tuned to the frequency corresponding to polaritons, but at the output you will actually see only photons coming out one by one, because they can couple to this state only one by one, right? So you actually have this as sort of a filter that produces single photons at the output. This was experimentally demonstrated by Jeff Kimball's group in Atomic Physics System in 2005. Another interesting thing that you can do with the same system is something that we refer to as the photon-induced tunneling. If you change the frequency of the input beam and you approach the cold cavity frequency, you reduce the probability of coupling the beam to the system, but you still have a finite probability, because remember, your polaritons have finite line width. They're limited by the cavity field decay. So you have a finite probability of coupling this laser beam, and obviously with two photons you can actually exactly reach the frequency of the second order dry state. So you expect to see bunching effects at the output, because you are more likely to transmit photons if they are coupled in ensembles. So again, as you approach the cold cavity frequency, photons would exit in bunching, because they would be used to reach where multiphoton transitions higher order dry states. And we demonstrated this effect. We measured statistics of the output photons, just to show you that in the last minute or so. We demonstrated statistics of the output photons. We used the laser beam at the input, but we changed its frequency, and we expect to actually see statistics of the output photons which differs from Poissonian. If we tune the frequency exactly to the polariton states, we see sub-Poissonian statistics, and this is the standard Cambry-Brown and Fitts-type measurement, which actually, to collect the output, sent to beam splitter, followed by two detectors. Ideally, these two detectors should never click together if you have single photon statistics, and this suppression of the central peak here indicates sub-Poissonian statistics. So we do observe that if you change the input frequency closer to the cold cavity frequency, we see super Poissonian statistics. This peak goes above the flat background, which would be true for laser, and if we actually completely scan the frequency of the input laser relative to the cold cavity frequency and measure this second order coherence function at time zero, which tells you what kind of statistics you have, you see the theoretically predicted bell curve, and you go from sub-Poissonian to super-Poissonian statistics. We were the first ones to demonstrate this complete curve in any material system. So in atomic physics, people have only probed photon blockade regimes so far. So why is this interesting? Well, one thing that you could obviously do is you could generate non-classical states of light on chip. You can take a laser, and then at the output you can look, you can produce sub-Poissonian statistics or super-Poissonian statistics if you wish. Obviously, we're working now on improving how strong the blockade effect is. So let me just summarize. I told you how quantum dot cavity platform could be actually used for cavity QED and cavity QED-based quantum information processing. I told you about optical and electro-optical switching at a single photon level, sub-central joule control. I told you about photon blockade, photon-induced tunneling. We have a series of nice tuning techniques for the system. And just to tell you what we plan to do next, and I will not really go into details of that. You can read it if you're interested, and it's posted on my group's website. I think the biggest challenge for these systems at the moment is to combine control of the quantum dot spin in the cavity with what we actually are able to do right now with cavity QED systems, or to do coherent mapping between the photon states and the quantum dot spin states, write and read operations. And people have done this, but for quantum dots without cavities. Nobody has done it yet with high Q cavities combined with cavity QED systems. I think that's the big challenge in our field. What we're trying to do is to bypass the approaches where you need really strong magnetic field, which would not be very practical in our opinion for quantum repeater to Zeeman split the levels of quantum dots. And we had some recent proposals where we could actually do this with magnetic fields that are lower than 0.2 Tesla, which would have actually very high speed, gigahertz speed, and very high fidelity of initialization with fields that could be produced with very small electromagnets. So that's what we're looking into doing next. And these are the people who actually did the lab work. My students, now former students, Dirk Englund, who will join Columbia faculty very soon, Ilya Fushman, Andre Faron, and the new group of people, Arka Majumdar, Carter Lin, Nicola Manquette, and the funding comes from ARO, ONR, DARPA, and NSF. Thank you very much for your attention.